Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, the MERS team is joined by former State House Speaker Jace Bolger and past Democratic Lieutenant Governor John D. Cherry to discuss if the legislature will adjourn early for 2023, which would allow the governor the authority to call special sessions and to set the agenda. Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Hill Harper also explains why he wants a competitive primary for 2024. Also, CEO Blake Resnick of Brink Drones talks about how drones can provide life-saving support in active shooter incidents and search and rescue missions. Now, here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber, editor Kyle Malin, and the boss, John Roering.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. We have another unique range of segments on our hands today. I was at the National Conference of State Legislatures 2023 Summit last week in Indianapolis. And at the end of the episode, we'll have an interview I recorded directly from the event on the future of drones in public safety and how Michigan can potentially improve its attractiveness to new technology companies. But to commence today's episode for a special sign-and-die roundtable, we have Jace Bolger, the former Michigan House Speaker and the current president of Tusker Strategies, a political and public policy consulting firm. Hi, Jace. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great. Additionally, we have former Democratic Lieutenant Governor John D. Cherry. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to see you.
And we are all here today to discuss the concept of early sign-and-die, the legislature adjourning early, potentially as early as sometime in September next month for the year, as opposed to the traditional sign-and-die date in December. And this is because of bills that the governor has signed into law that did not receive the necessary backing from Senate Republicans to become effective immediately. Things like the early presidential primary bill that aligns Michigan with the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee's new early primary schedule, a new phased-in tax structure for retirement incomes, and elections legislation dealing with notifications for permanent mail-only voters and ballot drop box inspections. All did not receive immediate effect and cannot be enacted until 90 days after lawmakers adjourn for the year. John Cherry, I want to start off with you. My question is, do Democrats in Lansing have any other option but to adjourn early for the year?
I don't think there are any other options. So the question comes down, do you want to have immediate effect and sign-and-die, or are you willing to let the laws go into effect at a later time? You know, in the end, the battles that these issues represented have been won in the long term. It's the short term that's at issue. For instance, take the presidential primary. That's been a 20-year battle within the Democratic Party, and it's been resolved. Maybe it's not been resolved for 2024, but for all future dates, it's been resolved. So the question is, do you have to have a short-term victory as well? And that all balances off against whether you want somebody other than yourself to control your own schedule. And that may seem like a simple question at first, but it gets more complex because in sign-and-die, the governor decides what's on the calendar. You don't as a legislator. And that, you're giving up some of your power. You know, it used to be another factor that fell into that was the federal tax code. It required so many session days. That's no longer a factor. But back in former days, that was an issue.
You know, I have a question for you, Jace. Do you think Republicans in the state Senate might regret this decision to not grant immediate effect, specifically because if there is an early sign-and-die, Governor Whitmer will have a constitutional authority to call lawmakers into special sessions to address an agenda of her own design?
No, I think Republicans are very much like, don't throw me in the briar patch. They see this as really a political potential win. I mean, if voters get upset about a bridge to nowhere, there's a lot for them to be irritated with in this last budget. But if past majorities were flipped over things like buying a chair, a new speaker's chair, you've got a situation where voters would be very upset to see their legislators quit work early and yet continue to get pay. I mean, if this does come down to the presidential primary, I think that is what it's all about. We can talk about any of the other issues, but there is a chance to have a do-over. There is a chance to have immediate effect. There is no contested primary on the Democrat side. It's Joe Biden. But if they want to stay in the same order, there's room for Democrats to move the date into the first couple days of March and still be in the exact same place in line that they are with February 27th. But why do they want to do February 27th? They want to do February 27th to advantage Donald Trump because they want him to be the nominee. They want him to be the one that they're running against, which I fear they're playing with fire. I think that Donald Trump could beat Joe Biden. And so they're playing a dangerous game by trying to force February 27th when they could have March 1st or 2nd and get immediate effect. They could have their tax bills with earned income tax credit and the pension special deal. They could bring those before on their own and do a new bill. And I'm pretty sure, and you could ask Senator Nesbitt, I think they get immediate effect on those.
I'm curious. I'd like to ask the Lieutenant Governor if during your time as either Lieutenant Governor or Minority Leader, and Jace, you too, as well as your time during Speaker, was there ever a consideration to changing signee die?
Well, there was discussions. I mean, there were issues. I mean, and during my time in the Senate, I was in the minority. I'm trying to think, you know, when I was in the House, we were in the majority, but Jim Blanchard was governor, and I'm not sure there was anything under consideration then. But when we were in the minority, there was always concern about whether the Republicans wanted to sign and die to get immediate effect on something they couldn't get it on in the legislature. Although I can say that back then there weren't as many fights over sign and die as there have been recently. By and large, there was more of a cooperative, you know, compromising approach to legislation than you see happening today. But it was there. But in the end, I think the majority party always said, you know, we control our own schedule now. Why give that up? If we went signee-die and had a special session, and you'd probably only do signee-die as if the governor agreed to call a special session. But even then, the governor decides what's on the calendar under the Constitution. And so even the majority says, you know, I might want a bill for my own local community that would happen. And you say, well, I can get that done in lame duck legislature. But boy, maybe the governor won't even allow that on the calendar. So you lose really opportunities if you sign and die early. And it just never got there.
Yeah, I think Lieutenant Governor Cherry is exactly right here, and that there's a difference between somebody with a statewide vision, a statewide campaign like a governor, and individual district campaigns and those individual district concerns. And so it's easy for me to say we never considered it because the Senate had a supermajority, Republican majority when I was there. So it never really was a consideration, but there's typically healthy tension between the legislature and the governor, even when they're of the same party. And a lot of that is driven by those individual legislator issues, those individual issues that pop up. And Lieutenant Governor is exactly right. If the governor calls a special session, not only does she, in this case, set the agenda, but all the bills are put on hold. As I understand, they've got to have new bills introduced for just that special session. So any legislator looks and says, the bill I've got introduced that's very important to my community can't even be considered because we've got to have new bills that are only the ones in line with what the governor tells us to do. And most of the time, a legislature gets a little tired of a governor telling them what to do.
Governor Cherry, I seem to remember back in the day when you were the minority leader, you had the opportunity to do exactly the same thing as what the Republicans did right here, which was deny immediate effect for something like, let's say, the budget. But you opted not to, in the end, pull that or play that card. Why not?
Well, in the budget process, I mean, first of all, you know, the budget process then is different than now. It was individual departments for the most part, and the subcommittee chair and the vice chair of the minority had a lot more power on those particular budgets. So there were a lot more compromising occurring at final passage or in conference committee. Mm-hmm. And so when you reach a compromise, you know, you give your word. You say, yeah, okay, if you give me this, I will be there and I will support it and I will pass it and I will give it immediate effect. So, I mean, those things were kind of worked out before the bill even was voted for on the floor. Now, you know, occasionally there'd be bitter division. And, you know, there were times, I guess, when we denied immediate effect. But for the most part, immediate effect was given because the compromises were reached ahead of time. Let's remember, too, that, you know, we always focus on our divisions. But, you know, even today, I think 90% of the bills that passed are done in a bipartisan way.
And then I got a follow up here for Jace. So do you see Republicans doing this more often going forward as far as denying maybe key pieces of legislation immediate effect and putting Democrats in a bind where if they feel like something needs to take effect immediately, they would have to adjourn sine die?
I think it depends on the topic. I think very much on the budget, it's like an election, and that is you may not agree with it, you may not like it, but once it's over, you got to implement it. And so I think they sell that with the budget. And what you also saw with the budget is people being willing to negotiate. As I understand it, the administration negotiated with the minority Republicans. They got some things. They by no means got everything they wanted. They certainly had some problems with the budget, but they still granted immediate effect. And so when I say it depends on the topic, it depends on how contentious it is. And it also depends on whether there was any negotiation. And that's where I go back to the primary issue. There's plenty of room to negotiate. I think there's wide open opportunities for both sides to get what they want. Every Republican vote to count because Republicans don't lose delegates and Democrats to remain the fourth state to go. There's room there if they want to collaborate, if they want to negotiate. But if it's just my way or the highway, then that's how you see these situations develop. And if it's just raw partisan politics, which I think is what this one is, when I say this, I mean the presidential primary, then there's not much room to negotiate if it's just about partisan advantage.
You think about, I mean, we sometimes overestimate the leverage that immediate effect is. I mean, think about it from the perspective of an individual legislature. And this year, I mean, why would perhaps I, as a state representative, really care about when the presidential primary occurs? I mean, yeah, that's important to the state party. And yeah, that's important to interest groups. And yeah, that's important perhaps to the governor. But why is that important to me? I mean, particularly this year, I mean, Joe Biden, I mean, is really not being challenged within the nominating process. There's opposition, but, you know, he's pretty well got it locked up. So why am I going to get all excited about this immediate effect question?
I'm curious. I'd like to ask both of you, as you know, Jace, you were a leader in the House, you were a minority leader in the Senate. If your governor and you were in the control of the chamber, if your governor came to you and said, we need to adjourn sine die for a specific piece of legislation, whatever it is, what would your demand as a chamber leader be of that governor? Would it be mutually setting an agenda? What would you lay out?
You know, I can't imagine giving that much power to the governor. Even Rick, Governor Snyder and I had a great relationship. We did a lot of things together. We still had our tensions. And I think what I would fear is if I agreed today to set the agenda, what happens next month? Once I've agreed to that, I wouldn't want the governor to have control over what was going on in the House while I were there. I thought that was the speaker's role. That's what the people elected the representatives. The representatives elect their leaders. And so I don't think it's the way the Constitution was drafted, intending to give the governor that much control. But I also think practically, when you're elected to office, you've got limited time there. You don't want to give away the limited authority you have to a governor.
And just think of all the process that Speaker Bulger would have to go through. He'd have to survey each one of his caucus members to find out what bills they'd want taken up. And every person he talked to, he'd be opening himself up to some sort of back blackmail arrangement. So, I mean, you'd be making his job almost impossible.
You know, Jace, I have a question for you. I mean, for someone who's still involved with the Lansing community and talking to lobbyists, I mean, how seriously are people taking the sine-die rumor? Are people already planning their vacation schedule around this? Is everyone all pretty sure that this is going to happen? Or is there still a bit of a will they not conversation going?
Well, I think a lot of Lansing odds makers are assuming it's going to happen. But there's enough question. It keeps coming back and forth. The Kasim feels like the moment I hear, oh, it's a done deal, it's fait accompli, they're going sine-die, I hear, well, wait a minute, some legislators are concerned about that, or one of the chamber leaders or the other is concerned about that. Certainly the mayoral elections in the House add a different dynamic on top of that. The House wouldn't have to meet, but still to be in control of their calendar would be empowering to the House. So that has some impact, meaning it's less giveaway if they're not going to meet a bunch, if they go into a tight situation. But it's not everything. And so I think there's still ongoing conversation. I think there's the odds makers would say they go sine die early, but I think the political folks are licking their chops over that.
Yeah, you just think about it. You know, there are interest groups that perhaps are more interested about sine die than legislators themselves. And they alone will keep the issue active because they'll be out there lobbying for it. Generally, they're not successful, but they'll lobby for it. I mean, there are people who want that those proposal two implementation laws put into effect now. And there are those who, particularly Democrats, who want that presidential primary to occur now. So they'll keep the issue alive. The question's whether the legislature can just back off of it in the face of that.
So here's a question I want both of you to answer. Early signee die, who is the biggest winner and who is the biggest loser?
Governor is the biggest winner.
Donald Trump's the biggest winner.
And why is that?
Because, I think that's the real motivation for February 27th presidential primary. And that is because Republicans lose 85% of their delegates if they were to hold the primary. So they can't hold the primary that day. They go to a convention. When they go to a convention, the current state party makeup nominates Donald Trump from Michigan. That's a lot of delegates. And so I think that's an advantage to Donald Trump, which I think is the real motivation for this.
Which has then becomes a victory for the governor.
It depends. Be careful what you wish for.
That's true. But in the end, it will be perceived as a victory for the governor.
Yeah. Well, who's the loser then?
I would say the legislature's the loser.
No, I think the voters are. Yeah. Through the legislature, the voters are, because they'll have a lot of priorities that they don't get done. And they will see, so what this legislature do, that again, there'll be some issues in the budget that people can make hay for that didn't impact the local community. And then therefore something outstanding didn't happen in my local community because they quit work early. And so I think the voters will lose and they'll see it that way.
You know, one interest group or one group of people that will be really impacted are lobbyists, because they set their calendar based on what, you know, and their timing as to when they want certain bills to go. This has got to throw everything up in the air for them, because in a lot of cases, they want to wait until lame duck or the end of session. This would be an end of session. This wouldn't be a lame duck, but they wait until that December time period and try and get everything ginned up there when everything's moving and there's a lot of action going on. This has got to throw that their schedule into complete flux, maybe more so than the legislators, Jace.
Yeah, there's nothing like a holiday or a vacation to clean your desk, right? That happens in our normal work, and it happens in the legislature too. I think there'll be a mix among multi-clients especially, but among lobbyists, associations. Do they not want anything else to happen? If they don't want anything else to happen, then they may join the bandwagon to call for an early signee die. If they've got the proverbial cats and dogs, they've got various issues for their clients. They are probably not enthused about a signee die, though they might like the extra quiet time. It's going to make it harder for them to get their things done.
You know, what type of precedent does this set? You know, the fact that we're even having this conversation, we're dedicating a whole podcast segment to early signee die. Does this indicate that policymaking has gotten so political that there's a chance that Michigan might no longer be a full-time legislature in this current decade?
I think it kind of depends upon what the real effect of signee die would be. I mean, if they signee die early, certain things are going to happen, and those are going to have political impacts. And if the legislators perceive them as positive, it'll encourage the tactic more in the future. If it's perceived as a negative, it'll say, let's not do that again. I think you really can't assess that until you see what really transpires, because you put certain things into effect immediately.
I'm curious to see if you guys think, if they do go forward with this, is there a way, a format, where they could actually make it a productive period of time legislatively?
Again, I go back to what the Lieutenant Governor said. I think the governor would be the winner. She's going to make a policy statement here coming up in the next couple of weeks. And then if she made the items within that framework, then they could continue to get the governor's work done. But that's where those individual legislators still chafe.
I agree with the speaker. I think that's generally the case. But there is one thing that I think where it could be a positive, and that's if, you know, one of the things that used to happen when I was on staff and when I was in the legislature, is we used to hold hearings all over the state. And that has kind of fallen by the wayside. You know, if they put that time to that kind of use, then in fact, that might have a positive effect. And in fact, you know, I mean, I think the speaker's correct. One of the issues are you earning your money if you've adjourned sine die? And I think you might want to go out and have hearings out there to show you're still focused, you're still working, and you're still trying to accomplish something. And so, you know, that might encourage it to happen. That'd be one thing that they could use that downtime for productively. But my guess is, in the end, that if they adjourn sine die, the governor's going to have an agenda, and the governor's going to call them back into session. And it may not be as long as it normally would, but there'll be a session, and it'll be on the topics the governor wants to have done. That'd be interesting negotiation, I think, Mr. Speaker, with the Republican leadership about what Republican bills are the governor going to put on the agenda. That could be a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah, that will be, especially with no margin for error in either chamber.
Right, yeah.
So I love playing odds, and if I had to put the odds on it, I'd say it's a 75% to 85% chance that they will adjourn early for sine die. Lieutenant Governor Cherry, what would you put the odds at?
Well, you're in better touch with the current legislature than I am. I would probably, by past practice and my general sense of how the process works, I would put it at 70-30 against early sine die. But that's said, I don't know the personalities, so it could be a whole different game.
What do you think, Jace?
I was going to say 60-40. 60% they do go sine die early, 40 they don't. But I think as more individual legislators start to contemplate what that means, that number goes down. And so I think Lieutenant Governor's already thinking about those individual legislators. And the question is, are they at a point where they're flexing their own muscle with their caucus leadership? Are they past that honeymoon enough? We saw coming out of the gate, it's not unusual. The governor and the legislature run fast when they've got new unified control. But then that wanes, that gets strained between the governor and legislative leaders typically, but even more so between those caucuses and those individual legislators. So I don't know if they're to the point where they're flexing their own muscles yet, but if they are, then the number's closer to where the lieutenant governor pegged it.
You know, but one thing we haven't talked about is how immediate effect occurred in the Senate back 40 years ago, even 30 years ago, when this was before the voting board, when the Secretary of the Senate, Burl Kenyon, would say, all in favor of immediate effect, and he'd take a piece of plastic and run it across the chamber and say 27, you know, or 26, or if he didn't want immediate effect, 23. You know, it was all, you know, and I'm telling you that 95 out of 100 times that count was never challenged. And so immediate effect was seldom denied in the Senate back then.
Yeah, and we're near the end of our segment here, but, you know, it does make me think, you know, here's this Democratic trifecta, and some of these current lawmakers spent a ton of money to get into that seat. Would you be happy being told, like, okay, well, you're going to have to go home early now, enjoy the extended in-district work period?
They may be tempted by that until they go home and hear about it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, former House Speaker Jace Bulger and former Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Thank you for joining us on today's segment of the MERS Monday podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Good to be with you. Good to see you, Governor Cherry.
Same, Speaker. Take care.
You too.
Joining us now on the MERS Monday podcast is Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Hill Harper, an actor and author, as well as a downtown Detroit business owner of the Roasting Plant Detroit, which I have not tried yet, despite my coffee connoisseur aspirations. I apologize, Hill.
Well, let me just say real quick, we certainly have the best coffee in Michigan, We fresh roast in the store. 9 different varietals of green beans are in there, and you will not be disappointed. So please, please, please come into the Roasting Plant.
I do love a coffee shop that's like by your neighborhood, though, the Congregation in Detroit.
Well, Congregation is great. You know, my son and the owner of the Congregation, Amy, her son, Odin, we're good friends. My son and Odin are good friends. And they go, they're actually at camp together today. And so they're playing together. She came over and picked up Pierce this morning. So I love the Congregation. Thursday nights at the Congregation is packed, and it's a great coffee shop, has a great vibe. People get together. That's one thing I love about coffee. And the reason why I opened a coffee business in the first place is that I truly believe coffee is community. It brings people together. It allows people to ideate, to do business together, to be creative together. And also it gives you a little bit of energy and it's healthy. So it's a win-win. I thought it was one of those businesses where you could do well and do good at the same time.
Now, Hildo, but my first real question for you is, one, how long have you lived in Detroit? And what makes you feel ready to represent Michigan as a whole in the U.S. Senate?
Okay. Well, I have lived in Detroit since I bought my house here, which was 2016, about 7 years ago. I had made a mental note, and the history of this is, when I was at Harvard Law School and the Kennedy School of Government, I had a roommate for all 4 years from Michigan. His name is Brian Mathis, and he, his father is one of the most prominent African-American doctors in Grand Rapids, and he went to the University of Michigan. And so he was marrying a very prominent Detroiter, a daughter of a very prominent Detroit family. Her name is Carla Diggs, Judge Diggs's daughter. And my first time here was for their wedding at the Detroit Athletic Club when I was at Harvard. But fast forward, I did a set of films here, and my friend Derek Albert was like, "Man, you got to buy a house here. What are you going to do? You should live here." And I truly felt the same way. I think the greatest people in the world live here. And for me, I decided at that point I didn't have kids. When I have kids, I'm going to raise them here because I'd like my children to turn out like the people here and not necessarily like the people in Hollywood. So I adopted my son on his birthday, which is December 19th, 2015. And I started looking for a house here, moved here in 2016. Took me a little bit. I rented it first, took me a little bit to find the house I wanted. And I was so fortunate to be able to purchase the house where I'm talking to you from now, which is the Charles T. Fisher Mansion. It was built about 101 years ago. And it's been a joy to try to renovate it and bring it back to its original glory, because certainly when I purchased it 7 years ago, it was not that in that state. So it's you know, a lot of people told me don't do it, but it's been great. And to be a part of this community and to be able to experience all the things that Michigan has, I'm so proud and happy that I chose Michigan. And my son loves it here, and we're enjoying it.
Now, Hill, my understanding, though, is that you ended up raising your child outside of Detroit. Is that accurate? I saw a report that he actually went to school in Washington. Can you clear that up for us?
Yeah, sure. I'm a single dad, and he goes where I work. So the thing is, when you do the profession I've done most of my life, you don't work in one place. And so you have a home base, which, you know, this is my home base. And if I have a job or I get a job, he's going to go with me. I'm, as a single father, I'm not going to leave him somewhere else. So he's got to come with me. And there's a lot of families out there that understand this, that they have to be on the road to work and to earn money to feed their families and pay their bills. And for me, it's no different. You know, it's just like we talk about unions. You know, I was at the UAW Local 600 yesterday talking about the SAG-AFTRA strike, because I'm on strike right now. And so it's just like that. There's a potential UAW strike vote coming up, and we were talking about that. They were, you know, talking to somebody who is currently on strike like me and talking about the potential strike vote. But it's he goes wherever I go, and I'm happy that he does.
You know, by the time that you officially jumped into this race, you know, the Democratic primary was already shaping up to have Alyssa Slotkin, Pamela Pugh, the president of our state board of education, and then also Leslie Love, a former Detroit lawmaker. are you concerned at all about this Democratic primary kind of turning into a Lord of the Flies situation?
No, you know, it is an open seat primary, and that's exciting. I think that there should be many, many, many more people running. I mean, if we look back when Barack Obama won the Democratic primary in Illinois, I believe there were 10 or 11 people who were announced candidates. I think somewhere between 7 or 8 made the actual ballot, and he ultimately won with somewhere between 23, 24 point some percent of the vote. And so open seats are just that, and the primary process is just that. And so I believe people should be vying for the values that Michigan voters want to see. And so the more people that are in that, having that debate and being able to talk about these things and seeing whose values resonate with the Democratic voter in Michigan. And I think that from me traveling around the state as I have, I've been all over talking to folks from completely different walks of life everywhere, because we know how diverse this great state is. It's become pretty clear to me that my values are very much in line with the Michigan Democratic voters' values, and I'm very happy about that. It's not to say that the other candidates' values aren't in line. I'm not trying to say that only my values are in line, but there are some wonderful candidates in the race. Some more may get in, and I think that that's okay. We should be having these debates. There should be people talking about this, because you're talking about a U.S. Senate seat, which is one of the most important seats in all of our government, particularly in the context of this 50-50 Senate. And so who sits in that seat really matters. And I think that multiple people should be talking about why they believe they are best positioned for that, and let the voters decide.
You know, it seems that you, Pamela Pugh, Leslie Love, have all expressed this frustration when it comes to Alyssa Slotkin, you know, concern that she might have seemed like a built-in candidate by, you know, Democratic insiders. Do you three have any type of agreement to, you know, maybe somebody drops out closer to the race to prevent the vote from being ridiculously split up?
You know, I think it's a false narrative a year before an open seat primary to talk about votes being split or even talk about other candidates. I don't talk. And so I don't know if you said that I've expressed frustration. I've talked about the establishment weighing in on a race. I haven't actually spoken about any candidate specifically, because I think it's disrespectful to talk about one candidate over the other in an open seat context in that way. And so I haven't actually talked about I don't mention the names of other candidates, because I still think it's an open seat there. I think that there may be 2 or 3 other people still coming, you know, but the problem really is the establishment feeling that they should be weighing in on the choice that Michiganders should be weighing in on when it comes to August 6, 2024. And when I say the establishment, I'm talking about people in Washington, D.C. And that's the problem that I have. In whatever way they decide they want to weigh in, let the voters hear from the candidates themselves. Let them decide what candidates they feel they resonate with and reflect their values. And then let the Michigan voters vote in an open primary. That's democratic, yet we're not seeing that happen. And that's why I say Washington should stay out of this.
But to be clear, Hill, the establishment candidate is Alyssa Slotkin, correct?
It seems so.
Okay.
It seems so. But that's not to say that candidate has welcomed that attention. See, that's what I'm saying. I don't want to speak about the individual. The individual candidate has never spoken about that. So in many ways, it could be a situation where behind the doors, she's saying the same thing. They need to get out of here. What are they doing? You know, let me be the candidate. Don't get involved in this. And so I can't speak about that in that way. If I'm making sense, I think it's disrespectful to make those types of assumptions. I love the democratic process. I love democracy, and I want to see it play out the way it's designed. That's why we have primaries, voted on primaries, not selections of committees deciding who the candidate is for November. And if it's set up this way for a voted on primary process, then we should respect that process and allow it to play out in a democratic way.
I got another question here. You mentioned earlier that you are part of an organized labor union. Do you see yourself continuing your profession as an actor if you are elected to the U.S. Senate and continuing that membership with the Writers Guild?
Well, I'm not with the Writers Guild. I'm with SAG-AFTRA.
Okay.
But we are on strike alongside the Writers Guild, and SAG-AFTRA is a member of the AFL-CIO.
Okay.
So just for clarity purposes, I was formerly elected to the national board of SAG-AFTRA, on which I served for 4 years. I think, you know, there have been some other political figures like Ronald Reagan who served. In the SAG-AFTRA board capacity as well. And so when we think about that membership, I will be very proud to say and for folks to know that if I'm elected as Michigan's next U.S. Senator, I would be the only member of the United States Senate who is a current active union member. And yes, I would keep my union card.
Okay.
Now, I wouldn't spend any time acting, but I would keep my active union membership because I truly believe there should be at least one, there should be more, quite frankly, members of the U.S. Senate who are current active union members and who are willing to fight for labor. And if they're in the United States Senate on the floor arguing a position, they can reach into their wallet and hold out their union card and hold it up proudly and say, I fight for labor and I'm willing to fight for labor and I'm willing to pay my union dues to support other people who are part of a labor movement. And so I'm going to be one of those if the people of Michigan decide to send me to the U.S. Senate as their representative.
You know, I do have kind of wanting some technical clarity, some, you know, understanding how it works to be both an actor and someone who's running for U.S. Senate. Does that impact how often The Good Doctor can air?
No, it doesn't. I went to Harvard Law School, so I know something about the law. But let me say this: I am not a federal elections expert, so I can't speak to every nuance of what that means. But it doesn't at all. But to be clear, I'm not shooting a show. And you mentioned actor. You know, one of the fears I do have, to be quite honest, is that the Michigan voter will see me as just that, as just an actor. When I have a wealth and depth of experience in so many other areas, you know, I was a presidential appointee. President Obama appointed me to the president's cancer panel, not in part because I am a cancer survivor and a proud cancer survivor, but also because the recommendations we could make to the White House around cancer policy at that point, an extremely important time in cancer policy, because then Vice President Biden was ushering through his cancer moonshot because it's such a personal issue for him. And so we worked alongside then Vice President Biden, worked alongside the National Institute of Health, even worked alongside folks from the CDC and other places to usher in really great recommendations to the White House, many of which they acted upon. Being a small business owner and the aforementioned union member, being a single father who adopted a son, you know, these are my life experiences. Being someone who's run, who's authored 4 New York Times bestselling books that seek to empower communities, particularly marginalized communities, and being an activist for those communities, those are the experiences I want Michiganders to know about me, in addition to being an actor, because I'm very proud of the fact that when I started acting, I wanted to be like Paul Robeson, who went to Columbia Law School and was an activist. I wanted to be like Harry Belafonte, who ultimately became a mentor of mine and gave me advice, or like Sidney Poitier. I wanted to make change through the acting profession, but also be political and be an activist in that. And so I'm not ashamed, and I'm proud to have achieved success and arguably one of, if not the most competitive profession in the world. So I'm proud of that, but I don't want to be limited by people just perceiving me as just an actor, because that could be limiting to the voter. They have to know my whole story.
Through this campaign, what is one issue that you really want to highlight that you feel that other Democrats aren't talking about right now?
We know that there's a mental health crisis going on in our country with our young people. Over 60% of our young people are battling mental health crises. We understand that there's an inextricable link between opioid addiction, drug addiction, homelessness, and mental health. We also understand that our jails have become our number one mental health providing and facility. And those things aren't sustainable. They're all interconnected. And no one is really talking about it. And you go across this country, there are massive amounts of unhoused people dealing with mental health issues. There's a massive amount of depression and fragility. And I think that we have to take that head on. And that becomes a part of a bigger conversation about how we approach healthcare in this country. But certainly mental health has to be one. And maybe it's on my radar, you know, a lot because my father was a psychiatrist. You know, I was born in Iowa. And my father was a psychiatrist in Fort Madison, Iowa, in a prison there. That's a prison town on the Mississippi River. And he worked in that prison. And he would often talk to me about many of those people that he worked with in that prison. They didn't belong to be there. They shouldn't be there. They should be getting mental health counseling outside of a prison. And these are things that have been happening for a long time, but have gotten significantly worse. And I think we all can agree on that.
There's going to be a lot of public policy questions that you'll get throughout the campaign. We don't have much time here left, but I'll just hit one that is pretty prominent still. Is the United States too involved in the battle in Ukraine, in the war in Ukraine and Russia?
You know what? When I think about that issue, I think the Biden administration has gotten it right, spot on. You know, obviously, we don't want to be in a situation where we're putting our American soldiers' lives at risk. But at the same time, I think globally, there is a battle going on between democracy and authoritarianism. And we have to be a part of that battle, and we have to celebrate as well as undergird democracy globally. And I think that has to always be a part of our decision-making rubric about how we get involved and in what ways we get involved. Most importantly, not putting American lives at risk on foreign soil. You know, no one wants a Vietnam situation, obviously. But at the same time, we are seeing it even happen here domestically. We have to vigilantly undergird and support democracy in our own country and around the world.
You know, we are near the end. We have 1 minute left of this segment. But quick question for you. How soon do you want there to be a Democratic primary debate?
You know, I think it should come whenever we feel that the field is finalized. You know, I don't think that there should be a debate scheduled before we know that all folks are in the room. We have to be very clear. It's still basically a year away from an open seat primary. And I think that there's time for other people to potentially get in the race. There's time for folks to get to know who's actually running. And you want to do the debate, quite frankly, when people are paying attention. You know, nobody wants to have these debates in a vacuum where, you know, seven really interested people watch and nothing happens. And I think that so I welcome the opportunity to have a conversation to talk about these issues so that the voting public in Michigan can get to know the differences between all the candidates. I'm excited about that opportunity because I think that from what I've been learning traveling across the state, I think that there's a lot of synchronicity between me and what people feel, because quite honestly, I'm not a politician. I'm a person just like everybody else who feels that they aren't being represented the way they would want to be out of Washington.
Well, thank you so much, Hill Harper, for joining us on today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. We greatly appreciate it. And hopefully I'll see you at a Techno Thursday at the congregation.
Okay, hopefully, Sam, we will. And I'll tell you, thank you for coming to the launch of my campaign. You know, we were expecting 200 or 300 people in downtown Detroit. We got about 1,000 or 1,200, which was just incredible. We then went to Pontiac in the afternoon. In the middle of the afternoon, we were expecting like 50 people. We had like 150, and then we ended up in Grand Rapids that evening. We were expecting like 200. We got 400 or 500. So there's a lot of energy behind our campaign. I think due in large part, to the Triple Blue leadership that we have in Michigan. The fact that folks are seeing real results right now by having Triple Blue leadership. And I think that they want, and this is what I'm feeling, that they want that same type of aggressive energy in Washington representing them that they're feeling here at home. And so I'm excited to represent that to the voting public. And I'm excited for you to go on the road with me again. Let's go.
Hello, MERS Monday listeners. I am calling in early at the National Conference of State Legislatures 2023 Summit in Indianapolis, and I'm sitting with Blake Resnick. Did I get the name right?
Yep, sure did.
Fantastic. Of Brink Drones, one of the largest drone makers in the United States, specifically dedicated to serving SWAT teams. The company's applications zoom in on supporting law enforcement, search and rescue missions, and hazmat operations.
Yep.
Nice to meet you, Blake.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, I know your company's story begins in your hometown of Las Vegas, following the October 2017 shooting at a music festival that resulted in 60 deaths. How did that tragic incident make you think that there is room for this technology in the public safety space?
Yeah, I mean, I knew people there, and it just, it sort of implanted this idea into my brain that technology could have helped first responders deal with that incident. That the right technologies in the right hands would have given them more situational awareness, would have taught them more about the incident sooner, and that they could have used that information to save more lives. And that's what kind of kicked off the company.
So when you think about public safety, when you think about how a drone can support a SWAT team, I mean,
Sure. What
exactly does it do? Is it providing, like, I hate to say this, but some sort of like weapons or defense mechanisms or?
Right. So they're totally unarmed. Basically, in a SWAT call out, a pretty normal way that this would escalate is someone commits a bad crime in a city. They're tracked down to a house or a business or a vehicle of some sort. They send out patrol officers. Patrol officers call out for a while to try to get the person to, you know, surrender and basically go to jail, but then the person refuses. So now you have an armed and dangerous person that just committed a bad crime inside of a structure refusing arrest. You kind of call in the SWAT team. Before a technology, what they would do is set up a big speaker system. They would call out for a couple of hours, and then if the person didn't agree to leave, they would put explosives on the front door, or they would just bash it in with a battering ram, and they would send in a dozen dudes with assault rifles to physically accomplish an arrest, which is extremely dangerous for everyone. It's dangerous for the officers, it's dangerous for the suspect, it's dangerous for the general public, because it's risking a gunfight. So our technology gives them something they can do before accepting that risk. Send in a drone, look around, find the person, talk to them. Our drone is a flying cell phone, so they can use it like that, put on a crisis negotiator, try to de-escalate before, you know, risking everyone's life with an in-person interdiction.
But then also when you think about some of the other elements here, I know that your website talks about fire safety. It talks about search and rescue. What does it bring to those tables?
Yeah, I mean, it's eyes and ears in dangerous places. So one example I can give, we responded to the Surfside condo collapse. I don't know if you remember that story, but it was a 14-story building. Half of it collapsed. The other half was still standing.
And where was this?
It was in Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was near Miami. So they had around 100 first responders with big circular saws cutting off pieces of concrete. Then they had a crane they were using to tow those chunks away. That's how they're looking for survivors. But you have all of these first responders right next to an actively structurally unstable 14-story building. if that would have collapsed like the other half, it would have been a much worse disaster. So what they had us do was take off the drone, fly it underground, that still standing portion of the structure. They had some structural engineers actually watching the video feeds coming off the drone through a pair of VR goggles. And they had us do some inspections of structural elements of that building they were worried about. And what we found was concerning enough to them that, along with some other evidence they collected, they decided to do a controlled demolition of that still standing portion of the building. So that would be one example. Another example would be just looking for survivors. I mean, mm-hmm. in a big earthquake scenario, for example, it can be very hard for first responders to search like the 14th, 15th story of a structure somewhere if the first couple stories are collapsed or internal stairways are collapsed, especially right after an incident happens where they don't have a lot of equipment on scene. So with our drone, you know, you can take it off, break out a window, fly inside, and then look for survivors pretty much immediately.
Yeah, I mean, you're obviously at NCSL where you're surrounded by a ton of lawmakers and a ton of government people. Yeah. Why are you here? What are you looking for?
Yeah, I mean, we sell to governments, and drones are highly regulated, you know, by the FAA, by state powers. So it's a really good opportunity for us to come and meet with a lot of folks and educate them about our use cases, how regulations are impacting those use cases. Like, we're very interested in this idea long term that you can use drones to respond to 911 calls and deliver emergency medical payloads. So delivering Narcan to someone having a drug overdose, for example, in 45 seconds. The problem, though, is if you try to take off a drone from a fire station, fly it 3 miles away to the location of a 911 call, you can't actually do that under current regulations. Like, you have to turn back the second you lose line of sight. Yeah.
Now, are those federal regulations or is it state specific?
That's a really good question. So FAA is the primary body that governs airspace, but there are a lot of issues that ultimately impact us that are also determined at a state level. So things around country of origin regulation, about where these parts are coming from, data security regulations. There are also additional laws that states can write on top of what the FAA is already doing. Certain states have become FAA like pilot program members. So certain territories within their state, more advanced drone operations are allowed. So all these things are very much intermingled.
And how do you, you know, navigate that type of conversation while also wanting, you know, local governments to feel empowered? I mean, a lot of people are concerned by the idea of autonomous drones. A lot of people are concerned about, you know, can this pick up images of my private property?
Totally.
What's your response to that?
There are absolutely legitimate privacy, you know, questions and conversations to be had about all of these technologies. I think that'll be relevant for delivery drones, which is going to be a major sector. That'll be relevant for automated inspection use cases. That'll be relevant for 911 response. But, you know, the areas where we operate, our drones fly during pretty bad situations. SWAT call out, it's a hostage situation, it's an earthquake, it's a hazmat issue. I think when our drones take off, they're responding to an active emergency, and they're put in danger, so human beings don't have to absorb that risk, so they don't have to be exposed to that dangerous situation. And, you know, I think it's just a public good, what we're working on.
Yeah, I mean, has your company specifically had an encounter where, because of a certain state's regulation, you weren't able to save a life?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. I don't think that's true at a state level, but I do think it's true at a federal level with FAA Part 107 regulations. It's so difficult for first responders to get the approvals they need in order to fly these more advanced drone missions that drones aren't being used in those use cases, and I do think that's costing lives. I think if every city in America had drones that could deliver defibrillators in 45 seconds, that would save people's lives. There are 100,000 American opioid deaths every year. That number could be dropped down if everyone could have Narcan 45 seconds after those 911 calls come in. And those types of missions just aren't allowed. So yes, I do think those federal regulations are costing lives, but at the state level, I don't think that's true right now.
You know, I know in Michigan, we recently passed a over $57 billion omnibus budget with $10 million going toward building up our drone infrastructure and our advanced aerial mobility infrastructure. But it seems that when you talk about drones and advanced aerial mobility, it's kind of dreamy. Like, you seem to enter this, like, sci-fi territory of, like, you can use this to deliver, you know, wedding cakes and pharmaceutical goods, and one day there's going to be flying taxis for everyone.
Right.
Is there a concern right now of people being too dreamsicle in their appropriations for this?
That's a fair question. I think, you know, I think those arguments might be pretty reasonable for some urban air mobility companies. It's just, that's a really hard problem. Battery technology is advancing, but it's advancing slowly. Flight times are low on those types of systems. There are huge federal regulatory issues when you start talking about, you know, taxis flying around without pilots, you know, flying in truly an autonomous way. I'm not sure that's going to happen in the short-term future. So, yeah, I mean, I could see those concerns. On the drone side, in particular, like drones being utilized to respond to 911 calls, that technology already exists. Like, there is no new technology that has to be invented for this concept to work. It's just the application of pre-existing technology to a new use case.
And then for your drones, there's a controller. Like, there's a there's a wizard behind the curtain, correct?
Yes.
And what are they powered by?
Yeah, batteries or compute. So batteries, they're all like lithium ion cells. So we're using, we're using some pretty cutting edge battery cells. Brand new, just came out a couple of months ago. Very high energy density, also very high discharge, so they can push out a lot of current. That might be too in the weeds, but I'm proud of our batteries. And then on the computation side, we're running basically Qualcomm Snapdragon processors, both on our aircraft, and we're using some different silicon in our controller, but they're both Linux computers. So our drone is basically a Linux computer, our handheld controller is a Linux computer, they're connected with an IP radio, and there's a ton of software on both sides that enable us to do our missions.
You know, I know that I mentioned the appropriation that Michigan has in our budget,
yeah.
But you know, do you have any perspective on what you think of Michigan? Do you have any people that you're working with in our state?
I mean, I love Michigan, 100%. I've gotten the opportunity to spend some time there. We have a lot of employees in the state, or folks that were born in Michigan and then ended up moving, like my chief of staff, Andrew Cote, sitting right next to me, proud past Michigan resident. I'm sure will be a future Michigan resident as well.
What do you think, you know, a state needs to bring to the table to really make itself truly competitive in this new drone industry?
In order to attract drone companies?
Yeah.
Yeah, or just enable operations of drones.
Ooh, how about both? Can I ask
for
both?
All right, let's do it. So, yeah, I think it's a good question. I grew up in Vegas. I founded Brink in Vegas. That's where our first office was. And then we still have a huge amount of headcount there. It's our second highest headcount city in the United States. But I determined that it wasn't a viable place for us to stay. And it's because there wasn't enough availability of talent, in particular engineering talent. So every single engineer that we hired, we ended up having to relocate into the state while we were there, which just ended up being unviable. So I would say that is sort of the first baseline sort of line that a state has to clear in order for drone companies like mine to reasonably be able to move and exist and grow there. So you need good education systems, you need good universities, you need relatively late stage technology companies with smart people that you can recruit from. That's sort of table stakes. From there, it's really nice to have good capital availability. So this is one thing that San Francisco gets very right. They have a massive community of venture capitalists that exist and can finance smart people doing ambitious things. That is incredibly helpful. And then for us, to some extent, it's also about supplier availability. Are there machine shops? Are there companies that can do printed circuit board assembly? Are there companies that can do quick turn injection molding projects? That helps a lot too. So
now, and what are, and I'm going to go abroad now with my question. I mean, could you talk to me about, you know, the concept of using American drones to assist in foreign matters, you know, such rather it be the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Right.
And then I believe that your drones also went to Turkey, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've been proud to help in these situations. So we created an organization within Brink called the Global Rescue Network. It's basically some staff within Brink and also some equipment that we've dedicated and trained to respond to active disasters around the world as they occur. So basically, we work really hard on all of these technologies. We want to make sure that the first responders who need it the most have access to it. And if they're not already customers, we don't want that to be a barrier to our stuff providing value and helping folks on the ground.
Because in Turkey, it was because there was the earthquakes, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we sent some Brink team members, multiple aircraft over there, got it on the ground, looked for survivors in partially collapsed buildings, helped with mapping missions. It was successful.
So I want to talk about the prices, too. Can I ask about that?
Yeah, sure.
So for a local law enforcement department, you know, let's say Detroit Police Department, I mean, how much would it cost for them to access these materials?
Yeah, so we have two main pricing structures. The first is a la carte, so they can just buy the drone, basically. And the second is our safeguard program. So that includes an initial delivery of our hardware. Then we're going to come out with Lemur 3 and Lemur 4 someday. You get upgrades to those systems as they come out. So around year 2.5 of the program, you get our new drone. Then year 5 of the program, you get our next generation drone. And then you also get an unlimited number of drone replacements. This is really important because our drones are designed to be put in risky situations. And what we found sometimes is our customers didn't want to send the drone in because they were worried about it getting destroyed during the mission and then them having to pay another X dollars in order to buy a new one. Mm-hmm. That isn't great. Like our drone is designed to take those risks. So within Safeguard, if a drone is ever crashed, destroyed in the line of duty, shot with a gun, flown into a ceiling fan, you name it, we'll replace it an unlimited number of times.
Okay, and the price tag of that is $90,000?
So it's around that over a five-year period. So it's, depending on configuration, it's like $15,000, $20,000 a year, that kind of thing.
So is that something that you would maybe hope that a state could appropriate for drone devices, not particularly yours, but any drone devices of these nature in a state budget?
Yeah, I mean, drones help keep first responders safe. That's just a reality. Our drones, there are many other manufacturers building very good stuff. I think they help find missing people. You know, they help deal with SWAT callouts in a way that doesn't result in gunfights. They help hazmat teams collect sensor data without having to risk one of their members' lives. They're absolutely a social net good, and I think it is a good investment of public funds.
What is one of your personal favorite success stories?
No, that's a good question. We have a lot. They all are very meaningful to me. You know, I actually have quite a lot of Ukrainian ancestry. I think our work in that country has been really phenomenal. Just helping their FEMA equivalent, their emergency services, scout buildings that were hit by cruise missiles or artillery, you know, getting eyes in, helping them find survivors. It's been very meaningful work.
No, definitely. And I think I saw in your Bloomberg profile that one of these drones, there was a shooter suspect and they gave him a like cigarette during a negotiation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we have around 500 public safety customers now all over the United States and world. So every day our drones are being used to respond to a SWAT call out, critical incident, hazmat mission. And that's a common use case. Like during a negotiation, a suspect might ask for a bottle of water, might ask for a pack of cigarettes. Sometimes it's helpful to deliver a cell phone to them. Our drones help with that kind of delivery.
you know, I think for my final questions, now that we're near the end here, is talking about young entrepreneurs. Because I know what you are 23, correct?
Yeah.
Is it okay if I ask that?
Yeah, it's fine.
I mean, how would you describe the current day ecosystem in our country when it comes to young minds wanting to develop devices, wanting to be young entrepreneurs?
I actually think it's really strong. I think the pool of venture capitalists in this country is truly world class. We are number one in this category by a significant margin. So capital exists for young, ambitious people that want to build something. I think people like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Elon and Jobs and Gates and, you know, all of these folks have sort of proven that you can be a young person, you can be a dropout, and still build a company that really matters and goes on to achieve enormous success. So I think investors are not opposed to funding young people. Like, it's something they are very much open to because they've just seen it work so magnificently, both with the examples I just gave, but also smaller companies that might be in their portfolio. There are many billion-dollar startups now that were started by 20-somethings. So that's made it easier. I think if you have the right background, you can attract world-class talent, even if you are a young person, hire great people. So, yeah, I mean, I think the climate is good.
But what is its biggest Achilles heel, though?
Well, you have less experience, right?
Yeah.
You have less experience. So you encounter many new situations. You know, you have to learn how to manage people. So, I mean, I wasn't a manager before Brink. You have to learn how to fundraise. You have to learn about government relations. You have to learn about sales. You have to learn about marketing. So you just don't enter into it with this broad base of experience you can pull from in order to execute on your job better. It's something you really do have to learn on the job. And I think it makes it hard, because if you fail to learn any of these critical disciplines in time, it sort of takes the company out. You know, like if a CEO is unable to learn how to manage effectively, that company's going to die at a pretty early stage. If a founder isn't able to figure out how to engineer a first product, a minimum viable product, the company isn't going to get off the ground. You know, if a founder isn't able to figure out how to build a sales team or how to recruit good salespeople, the company isn't really going to grow. So there are just all of these skills that you have to become proficient at incredibly quickly without a lot of prior experience in order for the company to work. And I mean, it is challenging.
No, definitely. And before we say goodbye, what is one message that you would want to give Michigan legislators, you know, if they want to make our state more attractive for a company like yours?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think focusing on some of the things that I mentioned, focusing on ensuring that there is a strong pipeline of brilliant engineers coming out of your technical schools. I think doing everything you can to incentivize large industrial players, technology players, in order to, you know, build large offices and manufacturing facilities in the state. I think that helps a lot. I think to some extent you can influence companies like mine with financial incentives, but I actually don't think that is really the most effective path. Mm-hmm. Like, even with incredible financial incentives, we wouldn't move our company to a place where we couldn't hire great local talent. So it's a lever, but I think a lot of elected officials kind of over-index on that. They think the financial incentives are the only thing that matters, when in reality it's a lot more about education and a lot more about if the big companies are there that startups like mine can recruit from. So, no. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Blake, for making the time to talk to me today and
Absolutely.
Joining us on the MERS Monday podcast. Hopefully the sound works out. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I'm sending the energy to the higher powers for
it. Yes. Thank you for having me. This is fun.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our morning Signee Die Roundtable participants, former Republican House Speaker Jace Bulger, now of Tusker Strategies, and past Democratic Lieutenant Governor John D. Cherry. Additionally, thank you to Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Hill Harper and Blake Resnick, the founder and chief executive officer of Brink Drones. I also want to give a tremendous thanks to MERS editor Kyle Malin and our publisher, the boss, John Rurink. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Schreiber. Priscilla told me, don't you